Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled Putting Practical Idealism into Practice. We certainly invite our audience to visit us often at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events which are held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker. John Hammack is an associate professor of public policy at the Fletcher School of Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts, just north of Boston. He teaches ethics, development, and international management for NGOs, or non-governmental organizations. He is the North American director of the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative, established to build a multidimensional economic framework for reducing poverty, and it's grounded in people's experiences and values. He was founder and director of the Feinstein International Famine Center at Tufts University. The Famine Center undertakes research and provides technical assistance in humanitarian emergencies. John was president of Oxfam America for 11 years and served as executive director of Acción International that provides credit to microenterprises. He has just published a book entitled Practical Idealists, Changing the World and Getting Paid. He holds a doctoral degree in international relations from the Fletcher School at Tufts University and an honorary doctor of laws degree from Denison University. And he was born in Cuba. Please join me in welcoming John Hammack.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. When I started teaching graduate school a few years ago, most of the students were between 25 and 35, and they all wanted to change the world. I was teaching a course on ethics, and everybody wanted to go out and say, change the world. And many of them would call me up 5 years after they graduated and say, you know, somehow I'm not doing what I wanted to do. I'm working for Exxon, or I'm working for a big corporation, which is not what I wanted to do. I wanted to be doing something else. And so I started thinking about the fact that, is it possible in today's world to be an idealist, to do what you want to do in terms of your own work, but to make enough money to be able to make it happen? In other words, most of the people I was teaching did not want to be Mother Teresa. They actually wanted to be slightly above Mother Teresa in terms of how much money they made, but they wanted to change the world. Is it possible to do? This little book, which I'm going to urge you all to buy, of course, from a very nice bookstore, it just started. So it's imagine starting a bookstore in this crazy time. Anyway, the fellow back there just started a bookstore, so it's worth buying the book just to support him. Forget the book. So in any event, the point of the book is basically that. But what I want to do tonight is to have us try to engage with that question. Because even though this book was primarily written for 25 to 35-year-olds, people who've read it who are more my age or your age have also said, you know what? That's applicable not just for young folks. It's applicable for anybody who's thinking of changing a career or who's about to retire, who's actually just thinking about their life. So my first question is, and this is going to be an interactive session, by the way, I hope, let's stop and think for a second. What in the world right now scares you? In other words, if you're looking out at the world today and you're thinking about what's happening in today's world, what gets you sort of thinking, wow, you know, things are rough. Things are hard right now. What scares you? Yeah.
The clash of civilizations between the West and the Islamic world and the Muslim Brotherhood stealth jihad in the U.S.? Well, all over the world we have, conflicts where Muslims aren't getting along with their neighbors. And you have, people that prescribe to the pure form of Islam, which is in essence a totalitarian, all-encompassing ideology, and then also what they're doing in the U.S. and the school systems and the courts and that sort of thing.
Okay, what else? What else scares you?
Let me give it another.
Yeah.
Global warming.
Yep. What else? Don't feel bashful. What else scares you?
poverty and how so many people in the less developed countries can be affected by the more developed countries, and how when we have no money, they actually get a lot more effect. There's a lot more effect on them than there is on us.
So poverty and the growing gap between the rich and the poor, which is true?
Polarization of political ideologies.
Okay, polarization.
Poverty and famine.
Poverty and drugs.
Violence
on the poverty and drugs too. Yep.
Violence on the street.
Violence on the streets. Okay.
Moral relativism. Situational ethics. If it feels good, do it. Okay. It's my truth. No objective truth.
Lack of standards. Of objective standards. Yep.
The prison system.
The prison system. Very good.
The nuclear arms race.
Still out there, isn't it? Don't hear much about it, but it's still out there.
Guns.
Guns?
Guns. The prevalence of guns in our society.
Okay.
Ignorance.
What do you mean by that?
I'm just thinking lack of education and information, real information to people.
Okay. Absolutely. Yeah.
Change of focus, retiring after 10 years of zero returns in the stock market.
That's a scary thing for people our age, right? All of a sudden you say, man, you know, I saved a little bit, and all of a sudden, whoops, it looked good, right? Well, that's why, in fact, it's interesting that sometimes there's the creativity that comes out of being a practical idealist is sometimes more relevant to us than it is to young folks. But anyway, we'll get to that. But anyways, we could go on, okay? I mean, right now, if you stop and think about it, one can get depressed in about 5 seconds, right? I mean, pretty quickly, you can sort of say, you know, wow, between the guns and the poverty and the religious intolerance and the ignorance and the lack of any sort of moral standards or whatever, I mean, one could get fairly depressed and say, you know, things are really rough. Things are horrible. At the same time, however, let's just take on 1 second to think about the flip side. Because at the same time as things are really, because we have to live in this world. I mean, we do have to live in this world that we're in right now. Yes.
The thing that keeps me optimistic, now I'm making it all emotional, is that there are a lot of good people doing what they can in their area of interest. You know, so you don't have to save the world alone. You just save a little part of it, and together we build a mountain, basically.
Not much we can say about that. That sums it up, basically. I mean, it's really good. That's a really good point. I mean, I was going to, and basically just to follow on, let's think about what turns you on right now. I tend to feel, and I have to let you all know that from the time I've been very young, I've been an optimist. And I've been an optimist my whole life. So that colors what I have to say, of course. But what I think of this moment of history as an incredible time also of opportunity. So what's out there? What's exciting about today besides the fact that there are people out there? All you got to do is open up your eyes and look. There are people doing some amazing things out there. What else is out there? What's happening that's good? Go for it.
Telediplomacy and the ability to spread communication quickly across the globe.
Okay, so the whole technological revolution, we don't even know how that's going to change the world, right? But, you know, all of a sudden you can have a mass movement of people on the internet, for good or ill, to do whatever, right? I mean, it's incredible stuff. And the question is, whoever uses it is going to use it. So it's a question of who gets out there and uses it, right? Okay, what else is...
President Obama's call to service and the increased rate of volunteerism.
Okay. Increased rate of volunteerism. Anything else? It is interesting, by the way. This is not unusual. Almost every time I give this talk, we can go on for about 40 minutes about what's wrong and what's good. People say, whoa, dude, it's harder to come up with that.
I'm really impressed to see the younger generation's desire to make a difference.
One of the things that impresses me the most about the research we did in this book, they're all 25 to, I mean, the 40, the, we talked to 50 people when we did this book, and they're all under 35, and they're all doing unbelievable little things. I mean, some of them are just incredible little stuff, but they've decided that's what they want to do, and they went out and did it. But it is impressive, the amount of young folks that are out there doing stuff, and I think it has a lot to do with this increased spirit of volunteerism and the increased idea that people want to serve, want to do something. What else? Yeah.
Global interdependency forces us to work together instead of against one.
Okay, so we have to learn how to work together one way or another. Okay, so all of us, whether we're your age or my age, we're all going to live in this world. That's what we're here. That's all what we have to do. We have to decide that this is where we live, whether we're in San Francisco or someplace else. But we are living in a world which has an incredible number of problems, but also has tremendous opportunities. So the question then becomes, what do you, if you think you want to be a practical idealist, whatever you think it might be, what do you think it takes to become one? What do you have to do? And what do you think we found in this book? Because this is not rocket science, okay? What do you think we found in this book that makes, that you have to do to become a practical idealist? Say you want to be a practical idealist. And that, by that I mean you want to do something that's good, idealistic, change the world, whatever you, but you want to be practical about it. And you want to make, and the subtitle of the book is Changing the World and Getting Paid, right? You want to get a little bit, at least get a little bit of money out of it. What do you think?
Start where you're at. Start with your own level of area of knowledge and where you're at. So, you know, because you're more able to affect change in something that you have some knowledge of, you know. So start where you're at.
Okay, so let's start where we're at.
There's going to be something in everybody's life that you're aware of that needs doing, that you can make a difference at.
Okay, so let's just take that as our starting place. Let's start where we're at. So where are we? I mean, no, I'm serious. So let's start where we are, because that's the first thing we want to do. What do you then want to do if you start where you are?
I actually called myself a human potential catalyst, because I asked that question years ago, and I came to that conclusion. And it's avocational. It's not what I've done for a vocation. Just today I was doing volunteering as one example of it.
Okay. One way to do it is to do exactly what you did. And some people, that's exactly, you know, the question that I asked in this book, is it possible to do as part of your career and job, not just as your volunteer work, to be a... But one way to do it is you work 40 years making a lot of money, and then you say, okay, that's it, now I'm going to do my good stuff. Or what I'm doing by making money is good in itself, and that is what I'm doing that's good. I mean, so there are lots of ways of skinning the cat, but let's get back to the point. Let's assume that, okay, we decided today we want to be... What's the first thing you got to do? What do you think you have to do to sort of get started in this whole business? Yeah.
Gain some expertise.
Yeah.
Gain some expertise in the subject that you're interested in.
Sorry, what?
Gain some expertise in the subject that you're interested in.
Okay. So let's put that whole thing to the side. One thing we're going to have to work on is skills. So let's hold that in abeyance for a minute. Skills. Well, before we get to skills, what do we have to do? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, what I did... I got a job that I was interested in and loved doing that supported my volunteer habit at night of my passion, which was helping to make the world a better place for people that I left behind in Africa with the desperately poor.
Okay.
And uniting groups of like-minded people with this passion because I didn't have all the expertise in all the areas to affect the change, but I knew other people who had expertise in all these different areas.
So now you've used a word a couple of times that I want to come back to before I get to you, okay? And that's the word passion. How'd you figure out what your passion was? And is that important?
It burns in your stomach. It burns in your soul. It's something you have to do in life.
Oh, okay. I was on a criminal jury last year for 3.5 months, and everyone said, oh, you poor thing, you've got jury duty. And it has totally changed my life. Besides becoming friends with a defendant and learning about everything from his point of view, I've changed careers, and I'm a paralegal intern at the public defender's office and applying to law school, and I'm 57 years old.
Well, I was going to say you need to find something that you love doing, something that's really positive for you and brings you pleasure and joy so that you have energy to sustain yourself.
I just kind of want to take that a little bit further. When when I think of passion, for me, it's, you know, I created a career out of what was important to me, which was corporate transparency, because it was so important to me that doing anything else for a living was a waste of time.
So the first thing you have to do, I gather from what you're saying, is that you got to stop for at least 5 minutes. Maybe go on a retreat, maybe take a long shower, but somewhere along the line, you have to stop and figure out what your passion is. It's amazing to me, especially how many young people get to college, and everybody's doing X. They're all doing Y. And career services are pushing you to do X and Y because they want you to also maximize the dollars. Because if you leave and get more money, it looks good on career services, especially if you're in grad school. If you leave and you make more money, then they can advertise and say, hey, come to our school because when you graduate, you can make more money. They don't say, come to my graduate school because when you leave, you're going to do what you're passionate in. That's not a criteria. So the first thing you've got to do, especially if you're in school, is you got to stop and say, okay, school's about the head, but it's also about the heart. It's also about trying to figure out what do you want to do. And you don't have to be 25. You can be 4. You can be older, right? 57. Look at you. You did it when you were 40, right? I mean, my friend here, he decided 40. Okay, change career. It can be done. I do it every 10 years, no problem. Because, again, one has to redefine what turns you on. What is passionate? What's driving you? Now, some people are passionate about one thing their whole life. God bless them. Other people get different things that move them on. But the first thing that we found is that, and the first thing we found from all the people we talked to is stop. Some people, it's all about interacting with another person. And it's that interaction that drives that you figure out who you are and your passion. Other times you got to go out and do a silent retreat and meditate with God for a week. Fine, whatever your system is. But the important thing is to stop, figure out what your passion, and then try to figure out what your values are. And then you have to ask yourself another question, because at least in today's society, in America, you have to ask yourself another question. I did this talk in England, and this question was not relevant in England. But the question that you have to ask yourself here is, how much is enough? How much is enough? If you want to have a McMansion or two, then you got to make enough money to have a McMansion or two. So when you say that you want to change the world and get paid, you also have to sort of figure out we want to live, but are you going to be satisfied if all your friends are making $200,000 and you're making $50,000? Or is the pressure going to be such, and we'll get to that in a minute, of your neighbors and friends that are going to push you to doing something else?
Question in the rest of the world.
What's that?
Why is that not a relevant question in England, for example?
I wish I could ask you. I misspoke because the irrelevant question in England was not that one, actually. The irrelevant question in England was more on terms of what they don't have to worry about in England is the loans. Here in this country, one of the big issues that students have in terms of living out their passion is that they have to make enough money to pay off loans. In England, they don't have loans because the educational system is quite different. And so I misspoke, actually. So thanks for the question. We're going to say something. No.
Well, I was going to say that sometimes you have to try a number of things to find your passion. And you may find that you may not have, the tolerance, you may have some to be politically involved in making something happen because of the crap that goes on in politics, for example.
That's really true, and especially, it's harder the older we get, but at least when you're in college and grad school, one of the best things you can do is do internships, is to do as much as you can to try stuff. Go on trips, like you guys just were gone to different parts of the world, to find out what turns you on or what doesn't. But just to take advantage of those resources that exist, volunteer. Go volunteer and figure out if that's something you want to do or not before you sign your life away. But there are things, but because you sometimes it's not that easy to know what it is that your passion is. And many times you have a lot of passions. That's fine, too. But the key is to try to figure out what is actually going to be. Is there something that I can do which I can get somewhat paid for somewhere that is going to basically be something that I can that I can feel good about and that motivates me to go to work every day? And what we found is that it isn't just in the nonprofit sector. One tends to think, oh, yeah, I'll go work for an NGO. No, there are people that we interviewed in the private sector, in the government sector, and in the nonprofit sector that are doing what they want to do. That's what they want to do. There's a guy in the private sector who wandered around for a long time, MBA that we interviewed, went to China, did some work in China with a company, and then finally decided that he didn't really want to work for a big company. He wanted to, and so he became his own entrepreneur. He started his own business doing environmental furniture and doing very well. And now, I got to tell you that it's not easy sometimes. These guys did not. It's not like all of a sudden, oh, yeah, okay, now I'm going to have a good time. And I saw, some of these people are having a hard time, because sometimes if you're following your passion, it's not just about skills, because that's one thing you have to have. But a lot of times when you're following your passion, you're going against the stream. Yeah, sometimes you're pitted against it. And sometimes, for example, you've got to not just have skills, you've got to have a community of support. Because if you don't have a community of support, you're going to have a lot of people out there who are going to say, you know, you're kind of nuts doing what you're doing. Why are you doing what you're doing? You got an MBA and you're doing what? You should be making $300,000. What are you doing this for? Or you went to grad school, or even... Or you spent 10 years working on this, or other people who will just basically all your friends start moving up the corporate ladder and making a lot of money, and you're still making $40,000 or $50,000. And you have to say, no, but that's what I want to do. You know, this is enough for me to live on. I'm living well. I'm motivated. I'm feeling good about it. And I see myself progressing so that I will have a life. But you have to make that decision. And you have to have friends and community. So one of the big things is, and who are your friends? How do you build a community of friends? How do you build who is your community? Who do you look for to support you? Yeah.
People who share the same passion. For example, healthcare for underserved population.
Okay, so people who share who are in the same boat with you. Okay, who share your passion. Who else? Who do you need support from? Yeah. Go for it.
I found that many times in other volunteers, because they seem to be geared toward helping others, which is something I like to do.
Yeah. So if you find other volunteers, people who've already decided that's what they want to do with their life, fine. People who haven't spoken want to speak up. I don't want to push you, but, you know, it's kind of fun.
Organizations. For coalition building, you build coalitions with organizations.
Okay.
They could bring a lot of people on board.
People who motivate you.
Like who? That's a very good one.
Well, as she said, other volunteers, maybe family members, or just reading books and being inspired that way.
Sometimes, and it's interesting, you know, like you got turned around by having this experience in a trial. Sometimes these epiphany moments can happen at all. You know, sometimes they can be in a lecture. Sometimes they can be talking to a friend. Sometimes it's reading a book. But the key is to be open to them. The key is to be open and to listen. We're not trained to listen. We're trained actually sometimes not to. So I think that's a really good point. And then the question is, you mentioned also family. Let's talk about family for a minute. Just because, you know, why not? Are families supportive or not? What do? You know, sometimes they're very supportive. Thank God. Some families say, "Kid, you know," or whatever. Sometimes, I mean, you can be a kid at 50, right? But I mean, your parents still think of you as a kid when you're 50. And they can say to you, they can be very supportive, or they can say, they can fight you the whole way, and say, you know, that might be your passion, but get real. You know, this is a capitalist society. Or this is a society which is in the middle of a downturn. You better get yourself a real job. And you sort of say to them, what's a real job in today's society? And nobody's safe now. So why don't I do what I want to do? Because it's just as safe as anything else. But yet, the question then becomes, how do you deal with that? And so one of the things we talk about in the book, too, is to not let it ride, to talk to your parents and talk to your family, but to do it on your terms. I mean, to go to people and say, here's why. And they don't have to agree with you, but at least they should understand who you are. And a lot of times there's a lot of miscommunication, and people just don't take the time to try to do that communication. But it really is important to take the time, because at the end of the day, family is, I believe, family is really important. And it's really important to have that kind of a back, support.
I have a question about your research and stuff. Do you find that men are less likely to live out their passion because they were sort of brought up to be breadwinners or have this idea that they're supposed to be the major person, whereas women are more supported by families? Oh, go do your thing. You know, you'll get married someday or whatever, even though they stay single all their lives.
The research that we did is not scientific, okay? This is not an academic study. Let me make that very clear. We went out to find people who had done this because we knew they were out there, but we wanted to find them. So we did. So we went out all over the country. We tried to find people in California, the Northwest, and the South, because we tried to find people in the private and the government and the different sectors, but it's not an academic study. So I don't know. I can just tell you anecdotally, quite a number of the people in this book are men. And they... That's true. And to be quite honest, in most of my classes, they tend to be, you know, about 75% women. And I don't think it has to do with anything about me. It has to do with the subject.
You handsome devil, you.
Anyway, but no, I mean, but I don't know. I mean, I think that certainly was the truth, or what people thought. I think that's. At least I hear a lot of that changing among young folks, but I don't know.
John, I'm gonna raise a question I could at this point too about this whole notion of support and other people. Because as we've begun through this kind of high energy exploration of all this, and I think one of the things you point out so well is the importance of just stop, think, so forth. But it did conjure up this image of stop and then decide what you're going to go do. And a lot of it, we have a notion of, I got to go be a doer, okay? So I got to go do. And in fact, the great thing about our Homo sapiens is we're thinkers and doers. So we act and we think, hopefully, in equal amounts or so of each of those. So what it brings to mind is, aside from the familial support group or friends and so forth for the individual support, it also occurs to me that most of our problems that really matter in this world are complex problems that need a high degree of interactivity with others. So we need others not only for support of ourselves and so forth and encouragement and that kind of thing, but it seems like we also need others in the sense that realizing, and the gentleman mentioned skills, and it seemed to me one of the things that we need are skills around conversational skills, and you mentioned obviously the need to listen. But this recognition of multi-stakeholders involved in complex problems, so as a part of my going out and rushing into the world and following my passions and doing, it seems like I also ought to be, along the way, conscious of the need to continue to develop those skills to interact with others in effective ways so that we have a 1+1=3. Would you just comment on that aspect?
It's a great question. And in fact, there's a whole chapter in this book about skills. And the skills that I'm talking about are precisely the ones you're talking about. That one of the things that the people who tend to be successful, the skills that we're talking about here are the skills of listening and the skills of communication. And not just communication one-on-one, but also learning how to communicate this way. In other words, how to present yourself. Because when you present yourself, then other people can present themselves to you. In other words, how do you articulate that which you believe in, your passion, so that you can actually get other people to share with you? So I think that's part of it. And I think the other point you make, which is really true, is that nothing can be done. Well, one of the things that I do believe is one person can do a lot. In other words, I do believe one person has a tremendous amount of power. But at the same time, in our society, you have a lot more power if you do stuff with people. And the more you build coalitions of people, as you were mentioning, in an organization or not in an organization, but just coalitions of people, and they don't have to be just your family and your colleagues. But one of the things that is interesting, too, today is that some of the stuff is personal, face-to-face, but there's a lot of also networking going on that's not face-to-face. It's actually very supportive also, which is the Internet. And people that are like-minded, but that are even in other countries that you start interacting with and having a support network with, of people you met at some point but you continue the relationship with. It's fascinating. You can do stuff now that you couldn't do many years ago if you're open to that technology. But in terms of skills, just before we But I think it's important to one of the things that comes out in this that in our research too is that some for some people it is important to have a real skill, like and then put that skill like a graphic artist. And then how do I take that graphic artist a skill and use it in a positive way rather than just just to make profit? And so the question is, so if for example you're passionate about nutrition or you're passionate about food and hunger issues and stuff, then you probably should go get some skills in how to deal effectively with humanitarian aid and that kind of stuff, which you can do. And then how do you apply those skills then in a way that's meaningful? So it isn't just a question of passion but it's also a question of you can't just go out there and do. You have to also know what you're doing. I mean, and hopefully do it within a context which will bring about change. And I'm gonna take a 5-second.
I just wanted to share a process, and this is something I learned in Oakland. During the dot-com boom, we had a 300% increase of evictions, and most of the people evicted were your low-income families, working-class families, seniors, and the disabled. And I decided I wanted to do something about this, and I started talking to my church members one by one. Within a year, I had my church on board, and I started talking to the director of the Interfaith Community Group in Oakland, and we were able to bring them on board.
Right.
And that gave that campaign enough moral authority to get passed. But you start one person at a time persuading, taking the case in a way that they can understand. And even though the religious community doesn't get much money from renters, and they could understand the impact of homelessness on people. So you start where they're coming from, and you sell it one person at a time, and eventually you reach a tipping point. You reach a mass at which you can make something happen.
That's very good. The
landlord community outfinanced that initiative 10 to 1. They had almost $1 million. We had 90,000, and we won because we won with sheer people power.
Yeah.
So you start where you're at.
No, it's a good example.
With the people
Thank you.
That you have one by one, eventually you reach a critical mass.
Thank you. That's a good example. Let me take this moment just to tell you something else that I'm working on, just because it ties in, I think, here somewhat, and I want to make sure I do this. I think what this book talks about and what we've been talking about is very individual. It's sort of the idea of how do I decide to stop, think about what my passion, my values, what is enough for me, and then how much is enough, not just in terms of money, but my balance. Nobody's talked about balance of your life. How do you balance this passion with everything else you want to do, which is have relationships with people, which there are other parts to life. How do you balance that? But the one thing the book is trying to say, I think, is that individually, life is not just about making money. That life is not just about how much money you make. And that success is not necessarily just about not money. Money is part of it, but that success is not just that. Now, when you look at society at a large, one of the things, the other project I'm working on, which I just want to mention, is that I'm involved with a program at Oxford called the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative, which is basically taking that same basic concept, but it's looking at it at a systems level and saying that economics is not, and a national economy is not just about making money and growth. That our whole economy right now is geared towards growth. And every time the economists get up, say the GDP grew by 5% or 11%, China's having a great year because it grew by 11%. We're not doing very well right now because we're at minus 1%. And it's all about gross domestic growth. Well, what we tend to feel, the economists that I'm working with in England, is doing the exact same thing as this book for individuals. Economics should not be just about growth. It's about growth. But it's also about the well-being of the people who live within that system. So it's not just about income. It's also about what your values are, what it is that the well-being of the people inside that economic system. So it's taking the same idea, really, at the individual level of saying life is not just about money and saying economics is not just about income and growth either. It's about how do we have an economic system that has growth and income so that we can actually then have the kind of society we want to have. And that measuring the growth, measuring well-being should be what we measure, not just growth. Anyway, that's an aside. If you're interested in that, there's a little brochure pamphlet on that. But on the Oxford Poverty Center, because I think it's a whole other way of looking at economics, which I think is also important, just like as another way of looking at our own personal lives. Skills, we talked about, and we talked about it briefly. We talked about community very briefly, and I think that's important. There's something else I want to talk about, though, and because we don't have, and I just want to get to it, because there's, and that's, let's talk about money. Let's talk about money. Because one of the things that we found in this is that there are two things that make it impossible for people to be a practical, or make it difficult for people to be a practical idealist. One is that they have tremendous loans when they get out of grad school and college, so that they have tremendous loans. And that may or may not apply to you, because you guys are most of you are not in college. But the second thing, which does apply to most of us, is credit card debt. That many of us have such bad credit ratings, or have such credit problems, that we have a very hard time thinking, oh, wait, I'm going to go do something new and innovative, because it just, the economics is such that you can't afford to do what you want to do. Is anybody, am I hitting any bells here at all? This is a harder thing to talk about publicly, because it's hard to sort of say, yeah, I got 10 credit cards and they're all overdue and I'm dying. But the average American has 8 credit cards, and the average American has an incredible amount of debt. And it's very hard to sort of say, okay, now my passion is such, and say I'm going to live it, if you're being dragged by the economics of your credit. And so one of the things that is important, and one of the things we talk about in this book, and one of the things these guys had to do, my daughter being one of them, by the way, I interviewed my daughter because I knew she'd had the problem and I needed the case. But I mean, it's a very scientific book. But my daughter did that. All of a sudden, my daughter woke up one morning and she had incredible debt. And I, you know, I thought I was a good parent. We were good parents, you know. But she, I don't know how she didn't figure it out, but she didn't. All of a sudden she decided, well, she better get another job. So she then figured out that she needed to work 2 jobs, and she did eventually pay off that credit and that debt. Now she teaches financial literacy because she thinks it's such an important thing for young folks, because most people get into financial crisis, and you don't have to be young, by the way. Most of us get into financial crisis no matter what our age is. And so the question is, there are some tips in this book, too, about how do you get out of a financial mess that you're in. There's a whole books on that, but so that this doesn't deal with it very in depth. But, I mean, there are things that one can do to try to get your credit back to the point where you can actually think about being a practical idealist, where you can actually think about, okay, now I can think about doing something else. Does that make sense to you? I mean, but the key there is, again, it's nothing, it's not earth-shattering. The key there is to say, again, stop. It is something I can do something about, and then start with small steps. Let's say you have 6 credit cards. You pick one, and you pay it off, and then you only have 5 credit cards. You know, and you instead of just paying $15 on each one, because then you'll never pay any of them off. So, I mean, there are little things like that, right? I mean, just little tricks of the trade on how to get yourself to the point where all of a sudden you might feel that you have the financial freedom to be able to do what you want to do. Now, for people your age, I'm picking on you, but for people who are younger, the key is not to get into problem in the first place, right? And, you know, okay, if your parents pay for everything, that's cool, but most parents don't. So the question then becomes, how do you then really try? For example, the same daughter's husband, he went to the bank and said, I'm going to grad school, I need a loan. The banker said, how much do you need? He said, I don't care. So the banker gave him a lot more than he needed. And he took it because he didn't realize. And of course, he didn't need that much money, but then he had to pay it back. So the first thing you got to do is make a really good assessment of your needs, what you want. Are you going to be able to pay it back? So one of the things about being a practical idealist, this is the practical side of being an idealist, okay? It's fun to be an idealist. So we can all be idealistic, but we have to make it work. And the way to make it work is you got to understand about money. You got to understand that you have to have some skills. The skills can be just volunteering skills in some cases, but you have to understand what your skills are, and then if you have to round yourself out, then what do you need to build on those skills to get to where you want to be? Does that make sense? Yeah.
A lot of times you can ease into something through volunteering. Yeah. You can build your skills.
No, that's one of the best ways to actually build your skills, and in fact, sometimes the best way to get a job is to volunteer. People used to ask me, how do I get a job at Oxfam? I said, hey, the best way to get a job at Oxfam is that there are about 400 people apply for every job at Oxfam, so you know your chances are pretty nil. But if you volunteer and they get to know you, if you have, then they get to know you. Then when your resume comes up, at least they know who it is, and they'll look at it. Now, you may not still get the job, but at least you know they looked at it, because they won't even look at most of the 400. So that's one option. Another option is internships. Another option is doing part-time stuff, doing after-work stuff, et cetera. I mean, there are lots of ways. And then also, the other way to do things is to talk to people. I mean, find out what people have done, what they've liked, what they've done. And the other thing, particularly young, don't be bashful. I mean, I'm talking about, especially I talk to a lot of foreign students, and they're very bashful. And you can't be. You have to basically go after people and bug them. And that's what they're there for. If you're going to college, you know, go to college, go talk. Professors, they think they're there to teach. Wrong. Professors are there to get you a job, okay? Professors are there for you to bug the hell out of them and tell them, how can you help me? And if you don't, somebody's going to ask them. So if you don't ask them, somebody else will. So you might as well be the person who asks them and gets them to help you. Because especially in a big university, they don't get to know very many students, right? So unless you bug them. And the same is true now. It's not a question of bugging. We were just talking about this earlier, Karen and I. If somebody doesn't respond to you, then you keep asking them politely until they do respond to you. I mean, it's not a question of being obnoxious. It's almost being obnoxious. But it's being obnoxious politely. No. Okay. In any event, what I wanted to do then is basically, did you want to say something, Karen? Later? Because one of the things that I wanted to do here was to start us to think about the process. Being a practical idealist is really whatever we want it to be for ourselves, but it's an individual thing, right? It isn't. I can't tell you what your values are. I can't tell you how to be a practical idealist. All I can tell you is that it's possible to be one, and that in today's climate, it's easier to be one, I think, than before. Because I think, not just because of the new administration and because they're pushing volunteerism, but I tend to believe that the economic downturn is also a time that actually helps one, a lot of times are forcing people to think creatively about their life and their careers. And I think, and sometimes it's unfortunate because I just, but it's also a time when, yes, things are rough, but in rough times it's also an opportunity time. Like it's this fellow who's just starting a bookstore. Who in their right mind would start a bookstore, right? And yet he sees a niche because some of the big bookstores are closing. So there's room for a one-person show here now that maybe wasn't there before. And so that's the kind of thinking I think a practical idealist has to do also, is what's out there, what's the market, what can happen, how do I take advantage? Karen, sorry.
I wanted to ask, since most of us in the room are probably at a point where we might be considering a career transition, or yes, we've already had a few decades of experience under our belt, what is the difference, and what things would you advise someone to consider in a midlife transition that's different than someone who's just starting out on the path? In other words, For those of us in the room here who are perhaps contemplating, do I jump into something new, what specific advice can you offer us?
That's a very good question, and one that is applicable to mid-career and also to people who are thinking of retiring. It's also a very good question. I think that some of the basic things are similar. Clearly, the internship, one of the chapters in the book talks about how to use your college and university to actually gain resources for what you want to do rather than what they want you to do. And so that you probably can't do because most of us are not. One thing you can do is go back to grad school and retool. That's probably not an option for most people. But one of the first things to do, I think, is to do an honest assessment. You've got 10 years of experience. You've got 20 years of experience. What have you done? What are your skills? What are you good at? What do you like? Because I mean, so what are your skills? What are you good at? And then again, the same discussions we just had. What is your passion? What's going to motivate you? What drives you? And sometimes it is going to take some retooling. It is going to take you to say, okay, I'm going to take a year. I'm going to keep my job, but while I'm keeping my job, I'm going to spend the rest half. At night, I'm going to then take another course to move or do something different. But I think you need to think about it strategically. You can't just sort of drop a job and say, okay, now. But I think you need to think about, like, well, let me just give my example. I mean, I've run this several times. I never just quit a job. I quit some really good jobs. I mean, like when I left the Oxfam, well, that was a little different. But there what I did was I did take several months right after. I was sort of burnt out after I left Oxfam. And I decided I needed to take 3 to 6 months just, and I could afford it. Now, and I got Tufts University to just give me a desk and an office for free. And so I just sat there, you know, and sort of thought for, I think that lasted for about a week. But you know, but then, and then that morphed into a job at Tufts. I don't know. I mean, all of a sudden something happened there and things developed. One of the things you have to be astute at is be open. And be open to the possibilities. In other words, you have to be, and that listening is not just listening, it's awareness. And sort of, and being aware of what's the potential around you is that you might be able to get into. I never thought when I went to Tufts that I was actually going to stay at Tufts and develop a whole project there on humanitarian aid. It just sort of there it was, you know, and it was there to be developed, and I developed it. And then I decided 5 years later that really wasn't what I wanted to do particularly. I wanted to do what I'm doing now. And so I then switched over. But I think, so one of the things to do is to be to do the same kinds of things. Think about what are your values, what are your passions, what are your skill sets. And then I think also you should have a network of people that is better than young folks in terms of the kind of people who can support you in also helping you to figure out what it is that you could be doing next. I mean, sometimes we have really good friends who know a lot more about us than we know about ourselves. So if we sit down and talk to them about stuff, they'll say, you know, here's what I hear you saying. So that kind of conversation can be very helpful too. But I'd like to ask that question. Other people have done this? Change careers? I mean, anybody want to share how the process worked?
I'd say that it's probably a lot easier to do mid-career than when you're first starting out, because you do have a lot of experience. You do have a lot of stuff to draw upon. And the network of people that are your support are also people that are like, wow, hey, I know a company that needs somebody like that. And so it's much easier to make the transition than you even imagine that it is.
I think it's being open to it. And I mean, my daughter always says, yeah, John, that's good because you're a white male with a PhD and you can just quit a job and fine, you'll get another one. And that's partly true. But at the same time, you do have to take a risk. There is a risk factor. And also a factor that you believe in yourself that you're going to be able to do something else. And you know what? You always end up doing something else. I mean, things do happen. It may not be exactly what you thought would happen, but something happens. Now, I want to leave time for questions. I mean, I know we've had questions around, and if anybody has any questions about anything that I've said or tried to say, it would be good to get them in now because we're getting close to the time.
Could we, before we do that, I'd like to have us put our hands together for John Hammack, please.
Oh, okay.
And I just want to remind our audience that we are listening to John Hammack from Tufts University, and he's been talking to us about practical idealism. And I want to toss this into the fray, if I can, as we move into the Q&A period and have you comment on it. And I've actually mentioned this at a couple of forums, so anybody who's been to a business and leadership forum before, they may have heard me say this, but I do love to connect the dots, and this particular dot seems very relevant here. And that is that, in fact, there's another higher institution out where you are, Babson College, and they're renowned for their entrepreneurship stuff. And we had a presentation last week on social entrepreneurship here at the club. But this whole notion of kind of thinking of ourselves as entrepreneurs. And Babson's College is a little saying, which I think is terrific. They say that first and foremost, entrepreneurship is a mindset. Okay, so it's a mindset. And then it says it's three things. Opportunity obsessed, number one. So entrepreneurship is a mindset, which is opportunity obsessed. That certainly is what you're highlighting people here to keep watch for those opportunities. Then it says it's holistic in approach. So clearly what you are talking about, capturing your values and so forth and bringing everything into the fray. And then leadership balanced. And, of course, that one we could peel that onion, I guess, in many different ways. But it seems along the lines of what you're talking about is this is a mindset, and it's opportunity obsessed and it's holistic. And go ahead and comment, please.
No, I think that you're absolutely right. I think It's I had the pleasure of being at the Skoll World Forum a couple weeks ago with a lot of entrepreneurs, and I would have to say that I would consider myself somewhat of an entrepreneur, just because everyone's, and I think because an entrepreneur doesn't have to be in the private sector. An entrepreneur has to be somebody who takes an opportunity and makes it happen. And I think we can all be entrepreneurs with that definition. And for me, the success for me has always been when you have a really good, there are lots of good ideas, but if you have the really good idea at the right time, because the timing has to be there too, and if you put that right idea with the right time with a little bit of money, you can do an awful lot. And that's I think what I've, the times that I've actually been reasonably successful is when you actually try to think through what is the right idea at this moment that will attract the funding, the passion, and the people to work on something. So, for example, when I started the Famine Center at Tufts, everybody wanted us to do a famine center, a center that was going to study famine. Well, you know, there were lots of people studying famine, and there was nobody studying humanitarian aid in war zones, and yet GOMA had just happened, which is a horrible place in Rwanda. The Rwanda had just happened, and nobody was doing that. And so the idea of doing famine was not the right idea. The right idea at that moment was we need to start, when nobody knew what they were doing in war zones and humanitarian aid. So that was the idea. So, but the idea was to crystallize the idea and then do something about it. So I think you're absolutely right. Other questions?
Hey, just a moment. Here we go.
Thank you. I'm at the International Relations Department at San Francisco State.
Oh, good.
I'd like to ask you two questions.
Good.
That are academic in nature. But do you think that a steady state economy is a possibility in the long term? And
What do you mean by a steady state economy?
Would be how we could all just wash each other's laundry, and that would be an okay economy. You don't need growth.
Right.
In the context of the environment, that might be a core concern. And the second question is, actually, let's go with that.
Let's go with that. Okay. I think that... I guess I think that there has to be some sort of growth. The question is, how do you do the growth? How do you contain? How do you make the growth do the kinds of stuff that will also help the environment itself? Because I think it's possible to do. I mean, because I do believe that creativity, the interesting thing about what I'm trying, because there are people who feel that I'm totally wrong, and I understand that. But I do believe that what is needed right now is a market system which has a human face. What's needed right now is a market system which says the market is there, but the market's there to serve the people in terms of our well-being. And the well-being includes economics, but also includes the environment. And the question then becomes, how do you design an economic system, economists, that actually builds that system that makes it work? And I think that's possible to do. And there's an economist, Amartya Sen, who started thinking about this kind of stuff a while ago, but other people have done that more. And I think that... but I'm not an economist, but I'm working with some really bright economists who I think they may not have the answer, but at least they think they have a shot at going in that direction. You had a question.
Just a moment.
Does somebody else have a question? Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Sorry. So I think that one of the really practical components of being an idealist is that once in a while, the economy just drops out of the bottom, and all of us in the nonprofit field just lose our jobs for a while, and then a few years later, we all get jobs again, and we're employed for a while.
We hope so.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that one piece of the equation is, first of all, how to eliminate those gaps when there are recessions. Like how to you know, smooth over those gaps, and how to really make sure that being a practical idealist is sustainable always, you know, without those gaps. But before I let you answer, I actually want to make one point, which is that I think part one of the assumptions of some of the dialogue today has been that you have to sacrifice financially in order to be a practical idealist. And I would say, just throw in there as a point, that here in the Bay Area, there's an incredibly vibrant for-profit economy. I work in nonprofit, and so we have to deal with these recessionary issues. But there's an incredibly vibrant for-profit economy, and if you want to get into that economy, you come to Global Exchange's Green Fest or the Green Business Forums or stuff like that, and find out about green business, because there's money to be made hand over foot, you know. So just want to make that point.
I stand corrected, because you're absolutely right. I mean, I believe very strongly that in the private sector, one can do an incredible amount of good. It can also do a lot of bad, but the nonprofit world can do a lot of bad too. I've seen it. I don't think it's a question. The question isn't so how much money you make. It's the question of how much money you feel comfortable making. And what a lot of the times what happens is that people get locked into thinking that they have to make a lot of money to be successful. And what I think one of the things I'm trying to say too is that you can do that, but that isn't necessarily the only path. And it's not in our society, because we get harped on in the time we were kids that to be successful we have to make more and more money. The key point, I think, is the one I'm trying to make in this society. Now, maybe it isn't in the Bay Area, but I think in this society, I think it is really important for people to also have the option of saying, I don't have to maximize my dollars and still be happy. But you're absolutely. Now, in terms of the ups and downs of nonprofits, the first thing I did at Oxfam America was to set up a reserve fund. Because when I got there, we had a budget shortfall of $150,000, which isn't a lot of money, and I was going to have to fire some people. And I said, that's ridiculous. So the next time we got a little bit of money, we saved some, and we made a reserve, which unfortunately small nonprofits have a hard time doing that. But larger nonprofits now do have that, and one should have 5 or 6 months of operating cash in the till, you know, so you don't have to fire somebody if the budget goes dead that same year. At least it gives you another half a year before you have to act immediately. So that's the only solution I know of to that problem.
Other questions?
About anything? we're over time anyway. So.
Well, John, I'd like to give you an opportunity, if you would, to what would you like us to go home and think about tonight? A couple of thoughts that you want to leave us with in terms of,
I think that if anything today, I hope that you've had a chance to reflect. I mean, about your own life. I mean, I don't have the solution for you. I barely have a solution for myself. But the important thing is to stop and think about your own life, about whether how that fits into your values and your passion, and whether you're thinking of changing or not changing, starting, changing careers. The important thing is to know that other people do it. I mean, I think the main thing about this book is that it is possible when you're starting off and also in the middle of your career and even when you're at the end of your career to decide to do things that you want to do, that give you meaning in life, that you don't have, that is a possibility for you. And to take the time and take a long shower even. And think about it. Now, you can't take a hot shower because that's environmentally not friendly. But you have to. But take some time to take a long. I can't take a long shower too either. Right, sorry about that. Anyway, forget the shower. You'll have to just stand there. Anyway, but I think that's the main thing. I think is just to think about the fact that, and also not just about yourself, but think about how you influence others. And how others either help or sometimes how you hurt others from being practical idealists. And so how you might be able to support others in their quest for what they want to do is as important as doing it for yourself, I think.
Can we put our hands together again, please? I want to thank John Hammack. I want to thank John Hammack for sharing with us tonight about practical idealism, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.